Tests have confirmed that a man found dead in Ireland didn't have Ebola. Health officials had been worried because he'd recently travelled to West Africa. The League Managers Association has apologised for the language it used in a statement put out in defence of Malky Mackay, but his former club Cardiff City aren't happy. Lee Stott reports.
Mackay denies sending texts that were sexist or homophobic, though has admitted messages disrespectful of other cultures. That, according to the LMA last night, was friendly banter. Cardiff say describing it like that is reprehensible and that Association Chief Exec Richard Bevan should resign. Veteran QPR manager Harry Redknapp's opinion of Mackay.
It's wrong if he has done what has been alleged. He's not a bad person, he's a fantastic lad. He's not murdered no one, he's not a rapist, he's not a paedophile.
Mackay and ex-colleague Ian Moody continue to be investigated by the FA.
And a man's been jailed for almost 3 years for filming a movie from the back of a cinema in the West Midlands and posting it online. It was downloaded 779,000 times. That's the latest. I'm Tom Howard.
BCFM Sports Saturday.
Come on! It is Sports Saturday with Paul Davis all the way through until 5
on your award-winning Bristol radio station.
Hooray, it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. And welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we've got nothing against Ujima Radio, our fellow community station here in Bristol, but what if the very name of the station were founded on a myth? Ujima is a key part of something called Kwanzaa, a fake version of African culture based on Karl Marx and cooked up in the United States in 1966 by Ron Karenga. He's a man whose group tried to bring down the Black Panthers over there. Also, as all eyes are on ISIS and Iraq, whatever happened to Libya? We hope to be joined, if the phone lines are working by then, by filmmaker Dave Roberts, whose film Libyan Crisis, Events, Causes and Facts documented the early stages of the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime in a country which has this week descended again into chaos with mysterious air raids taking place by nobody knows who overnight last night. That's probably the US or the Israelis. And emergency powers. What power does the government have to take away our rights in a time of crisis? We like to think it couldn't happen here, but under a state of emergency, Britain could become a very different place. Far from explaining this to us these days, government and the media are tight-lipped on the subject, with the Civil Contingencies Act is far less provision for us than in the old Civil Defence Act, which was before 9/11. So we go back to the 1980s when the BBC broadcast a whole programme about states of emergency. It's called In Time and Crisis, and everyone was surprised to see how much US forces would be in charge here in a state of emergency. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast for the bank holiday from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, some light rain, highs of 18 tomorrow, sunnier on Saturday, cloudier on Sunday with some light showers. Just getting ready for rain on Monday. That is rainy and cloudy on Monday. Next week, rest of the week, highs of 21 Celsius, a fairly cloudy week with plenty of showers. Next weekend, that's the 30th of August and the 1st of September, highs again up to 18 Celsius and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
We're going to start this week, Ron, with what, for me, is the big story of the week. I think they're going to be covering it on Points West as well tonight from 6:30. But it's Mark Leftley, is the associate business editor of the independent newspaper in London. He's gone on holiday this week. Before he went on holiday, he left us with this incredible bombshell of an article. Uproar, he says, it's an exclusive, as the Ministry of Defence brings in American giants to manage military procurement. Well, that's for the large part us. That's Abbey Wood, Defence Equipment and Support up there, which employs around about 21,000 Bristolians and people from around the region. And apparently it's all been secretly privatised. Unions and industry insiders are up in arms because because two US engineering companies and defence contractors have been asked to oversee the way in which the Ministry of Defence runs the £14 billion arm that buys military kit. The Independent can reveal that San Francisco-based Bechtel and Denver's CH2M will have bagged the programme management contracts for the Bristol-based defence equipment and support. This agency buys and looks after everything from forklift trucks to Astute-class submarines, but it's being overhauled by the government so as to get better value for the taxpayers. The companies were told earlier this week that they've won the contracts to transform the way in which these crucial items are bought in what's known as managed service provider roles, MSP roles. Well, he's talking about this week. Actually, that's last week. But Bechtel will look after the Navy and the RAF, while CH2M Hill will work with defence equipment and support on Army and Joint Command projects. Well, anyone that knows anything about the military knows it's the joint services stuff which is the real top of the military tree. So they've been given, I suppose, the top of those two jobs. Detailed negotiations are starting this week, and these talks will be important as the roles are widely considered to be vaguely defined. CH2M Hill, which worked on the 2012 Olympics, and Bechtel, which has overseen the construction of a 21-kilometre tunnel for London's Crossrail, have few suitable British employees to fill these contracts. Industry insiders estimate they will need 150 to 200 staff, and they'll be flying most of those in from the United States. Now, this is a bit of a bombshell, Ron, because at the beginning of this year we were told that the bidding process, only one company had bid, and that they, because only one company had bid, that the government had decided, the cabinet had decided, the Department of Defence had decided that it's actually not a good idea to privatise it when there's only one bidder. Now it looks like they've found two bidders, but the whole process has been shrouded in secrecy right from the start.
Well, yes, I come very late to this. I think it was 6 o'clock last night when I really understood what was going on. You've already indicated the number of staff that are already employed at Abbey Wood. And in the preamble here, you say forklift trucks and nuclear submarines. My quote was bootlaces to ballistic missiles, much the same, right? However, I think it poses a huge number of questions as to why this is happening at this point in time, how it's managed to happen in the way it has, how it affects the immediate staff, obviously, in relation to Abbey Wood. But more importantly, in my view, what will they be presenting contracts to next month, which is the news report goes on to say? What are they buying and where from? Because if you've got Americans at the top, does that mean to say that's going to affect people like BAC and some of the other industries that are tightly knit with the defence industry and all the employment in the southwest? And I think it's an extremely serious move, and I can understand fully why the local trade unions, one, not knowing anything about it and this bombshell, but two, the potential effects and the ripple effects right the way through the industry.
Martin, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this is a contract to manage defence equipment and support, actually at arm's length. So what's going to be happening is the previous Ministry of Defence managers are going to go, these private contractors are going to come in. Ultimately, how's that going to change the way things go for our 21,000 staff up at Abbey Wood?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, obviously the potential threat, I mean, certainly some managers will go and other managers will come in, but let's just think about what we're actually saying here. A private sector, two private sector organisations based in the US are going to take charge of the British government's procurement of private sector inputs for the Ministry of Defence. Now, I don't see, realistically, how the private sector can be engaged in procurement in that way. It's just a circular, ridiculous setup. Why the government, if it wants best value for money, ought to be able to get control its own inputs and decide who it wants to employ. But of course, this poses the fundamental problem with all military procurement, is that competition is virtually zero. It's not a competitive market. Two bidders is not a competitive market. If you look at your textbook, for a competitive market, you need hundreds or thousands of potential bidders. And, of course, effectively, what we're really talking about here is government consumption. And there's a very, very strong case for all arms expenditure to be entirely inside the public sector. Because otherwise, if it's in the private sector, pressure builds up to buy more and expensive kit, because that's the, that's what the suppliers want to provide. So you can see in the United States that the arms bill now is absolutely enormous, because there's enormous pressure from the arms companies for the taxpayer to buy more of their kit. And if you're talking about waste in the public sector, it certainly isn't people on sickness benefits. It's to be found up at Abbey Wood. And, of course, this is just further down the road of wasting taxpayers' money.
Ron, tell us a bit about the early days of Abbey Wood, because I know you were, you've been a councillor in the city for a long time, haven't you?
Yeah, no, nearly 30 years. And Abbey Wood emerged whilst we were Avon councillors. At that time, apart from giving them permission to be where they are, there was a huge debate and argument in relation to the some of the plush fittings in the head office. You know, the 3-inch deep shag pile and the very large, at that time, fountain and indoor water features, etc. And I don't know whether that was value for money or not, but... you know, that sort of thing, I don't think goes down too well.
I'll ask both of you this, because the Ministry of Defence procurement is a difficult one, isn't it? Because everything's surrounded with secrecy. That might, Ron, allow people to get away with all sorts of things. That is, say, for example, choosing a particular contractor because they're their mate down the pub. And then they'll say, well, I don't want you to scrutinise this because it's national security.
Well, this is the problem. When people want to be secretive, they usually claim, you know, crown immunity of some sort. And
Martin,
that's
is
danger.
That, is that sort of thing more or less likely to happen with
it's
these private contractors?
You've got two layers of cutout. It's likely to happen anyway, but if you've got private sector people doing the procuring from the private sector, where is the public interest in that? And, of course, you don't necessarily always want the cheapest, and in actual fact, if you're producing stuff, you want the best. And so, in actual fact, for example, the SA-80 rifle was originally designed to be produced in the public sector, was eventually subcontractors produced it, and, of course, what they did is they just scrimped on every aspect of the rifle, which is why the British Army hate it. And that's the kind of problem that you get when you've got the private sector involved in what is essentially public consumption. Military equipment should not be part of the private sector at all, under any circumstances, in principle.
Okay.
Because ultimately you end up with you being ripped off by the suppliers.
This is lots of money, lots of staff involved, £14 billion annually, that defence, Ministry of Defence arm is spending, also 21,000 staff, as I've said. Interesting thing about it is it's difficult as a journalist to get anyone to comment, and I think we're finding this in other journalists in the city, because everyone that works up there signs the Official Secrets Act, and so they're very worried. They think, well, if they come and talk to the journalist and explain this to the public, they'll be have their pension docked, they might even be jailed under the Official Secrets Act. So it's a very nervous kind of workforce that doesn't necessarily want to say, the difference, Martin, ultimately is not going to necessarily be a lot if these are expert companies at procuring things cheaper than the civil service have done. I mean, we know the civil service isn't perfect, is it? The Ministry of Defence.
No, but the civil service is at least accountable. And what you've got now is two layers of accountability. And the fact, look at the way this whole process has been carried out. This time last year, we were being told, we're not going to do it, we're sticking with the old system. Then suddenly, in the middle of the silly season, crash, bang, wallop, it's all done and dusted. Now, where was this discussed? Where was this discussed? In Bristol or anywhere else? It's just a fait accompli.
Separately, the reforms also involve the private sector taking over Defence Equipment and Support's Human Resources Department. It's understood that all of the big four accountancy firms bid for this role and that PricewaterhouseCoopers has landed the contract. The Ministry of Defence is highly sensitive about the reforms of Defence Equipment and Support last year. Ministers tried to semi-privatise the agency in what was known as GOCO, Government-Owned Contractor-Operated Model, but this plan collapsed, as I was saying earlier, over a lack of competition after CH2M Hill decided against bidding for the contract at the last minute, leaving Bechtel as the only bidder. But Bechtel have come back, and now they are running this. Also, human resources, this is another thing that does bother me, because there's quite a lot of sharp practice in human resources around the country. We've been hearing earlier on this week in news articles about NHS whistleblowers, for example, that human resources at the National Health Service are actually trained
to, and we'll be talking more about this next week actually, are actually trained to, when they get complaints which are problematic from individual members of staff in the health service, then they'll go on to a kind of blacklist. And what happens is the human resources are actually trained to then start employment proceedings against them to divert that person away from the complaint that they were originally doing, and often they don't even get looked into. So human resources, what you, we in the old days we used to call what was it?
Personnel,
of course. This is a biggie, isn't it, Ron?
Yeah. I mean, we've seen this in local government as well in relation to contracts and people questioning systems and bureaucracy, and the danger that people that ask reasonable questions in relation to value for money or indeed the legality of what's going on, etc., become persecuted and then blacklisted, sacked, and then virtually unemployable because of their actions. I don't think that's right. I mean, Martin's right, this is public money. And going back to the rifle issue that he raised earlier, I think there was four attempts to get one that would actually work properly in Afghanistan in a sandstorm.
Well, the argument is that they're hoping, anyway, that they will do better. Bechtel, people like that, will do better. One little news story from earlier on in the year, though, is a former Bechtel executive, he took $5 million in bribes when he was working on contracts over in Egypt.
Well, the fact is that the US military-industrial complex is a massive cancerous growth. And I'm afraid that Britain is probably, that's probably the only industrial sector in which we still have some major presence. But of course, it's all ultimately government consumption. If you're thinking of it in terms of all money spent on armaments is ultimately money that's not spent on human welfare. And that's the argument for putting it all in the public sector. And of course, at one time, most of the British armaments companies were in the public sector, including British Aerospace. The more private sector you have, the more pressure there is to buy expensive kit. When people have to spend the money on public expenditure to buy kit, they're faced with a clear choice. It's guns or butter. Do we want an aircraft carrier, or do we want X number of hospitals? But once you've got private companies making profit out of providing aircraft carriers, the pressure to have aircraft carriers rather than hospitals becomes overwhelming. And in the US, we've seen this completely as the welfare state's been smashed and the warfare state has been substituted.
Well, this is not the only... government, large government contract with big American defence contractors. Another one that's come up this week is Raytheon. UK taxpayers are now facing a £220 million bill over e-borders contract termination. A tribunal's found flaws in a process by which the UK border agency decided to scrap a contract with the US-based Raytheon in 2010. Taxpayers have been left to foot a £220 million bill after a tribunal ruled the government contract awarded to US defence firm Raytheon to deliver the e-borders programme was unlawfully terminated. A contract to put in place an electronic system to check travellers leaving and entering Britain was ended by the government in July 2010 because the Home Office said it had no confidence in Raytheon. This is another problem, Ron, isn't it? When you're looking at contracts like this, it's extremely secretive, and we're going to hear from the chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee, Keith Vaz, in a minute about this particular contract. They've been trying for months and months, years and years, to try and actually get some of the details of this contract out of the government, and even a government committee which is there to investigate these things has failed
up and vote for it.
They've tried everything they can to actually find to get the details of these contracts. Now I imagine with this defence equipment and support contract it will be even more impossible for MPs to scrutinise it.
I would have thought so. I would think it was very difficult. I've got two questions that I'd like an answer to if anybody out there does know one. One is, on the basis that this is going to be best value for money for the taxpayers, it's going to be a race to the bottom to make it and buy everything that's the cheapest. And the cheapest is not always the best, and it doesn't always work, like I said, with the gun. And secondly, one of the people that you ought to be asking questions of, I think, is Liam Fox. Where's his sticky fingers in all this? And if you remember... he went out on a number of jollies, in inverted commas, all around the world trying to procure contracts or sell various bits and pieces of British defence interests And I wonder, you know, has he had any involvement in this at all?
Don't know. I mean, I have tried to contact the Filton Bradley Stoke MP Jack Lopresti about it. He's busy, apparently. And also Stephen Williams, I've contacted him asking for a comment but haven't heard back. So I contacted a couple of the MPs to ask about it.
Well, that's Liam.
I think they were... I think, well, maybe Liam knows a bit about it. You're quite right.
Philip Hammond.
The interesting thing about this as well is that these contracts have just been signed, Martin, just as a new defence secretary's come in, literally within a few weeks of a new defence secretary. And it's almost like, well, those bits of paper might not have got past the previous foreign secretary or defence secretary, but they may get past this new one if it's like his first couple of days in office. Is he going to dare to not sign the contract?
Well, it seems that a lot of things are on a ratchet system, aren't they? That something has been decided at some level way above the political level, and they just keep knocking on the door until they get what they want. And we've seen the massive growth of military expenditure in the US, and of course the Britain on trying to get in on the coattails of that, all of which, if you think about it, is absolutely absurd. We fought the whole Cold War against the Soviet Union on far less military expenditure that we're now expending to chase a few ragtag terrorists around the far corners.
But surely
the
civil service is there to keep an eye on all this, and that's their job, surely, is to make sure, rather than to be hand in glove with big American defence contractors waiting for a new politician to come in to say, sign this piece of paper, please. They're supposed to be there, really, to make sure that due process is gone through and that there's enough scrutiny. And also, if they're signing a contract, that contract there is some kind of system set up to make sure that there's no possible fraud, because we've seen all sorts of problems with these previous contracts in the past.
One of the problems is that people working in the high-level civil service often end up working for the companies concerned.
This is the old revolving door syndrome. Yeah.
So you think Kinetic, which is based in Malvern, was originally a British government institution developing, you know, the most sophisticated weaponry, and it's been privatised. It's now owned by the Carlyle Group, which incidentally just happens to have lots of senior politicians, British and American, including John Major, on its board. So in other words, the politicians and the top civil servants agree to give the contract to Bechtel, and then, blow me down, they all end up on the board of Bechtel as soon as they've left.
Interesting,
office.
Fascinating. SM Al-Gawari, 72 years old, he is of Potomac, Maryland. He's a former Bechtel executive, and he took $5 million in kickbacks and bribes when he was in Egypt. Can we trust Bechtel to not be doing the same sort of thing with possible defence contractors and organising dodgy contracts up at Defence Equipment and Support Abbey Wood?
Well, I can answer that accurately, but my gut feeling is no, you can't.
OK, let's go now to look at this story I was mentioning a little bit earlier on about the e-borders contract and comparing that. You know, this is another big American defence contractor. That contract has completely collapsed this week. Well, it's not this week. It collapsed back in 2010. But the chickens are coming home to roost this week with a fine of £220 million as a tribunal has put onto the Home Office for terminating that contract. And, of course, it's meant that we haven't had any proper checks on people coming in out of the country since then. Anyway, so let's have a listen to Keith Vaz talking to he's the Home Affairs Select Committee chair, talking to the BBC earlier on this week.
It is a catastrophic result. At the end of the day, the government will be paying up much more than this, because of course they've already paid Raytheon some money for the work that they've done, and the committee has been asking for 6 years for the details of this contract. We've been asking to know what the benchmarks were when the contract was originally signed, and then the dramatic decision by the current government to suddenly terminate it without the programme being put into effect. Other countries like South Africa, Saudi Arabia, Australia, all who have an e-borders programme, and there's no reason why we shouldn't have had one in this country.
But if it wasn't working, if Raytheon weren't managing to do it, we might have ended up paying even more, mightn't we, for a system that still didn't work?
You're right, Justin, but we will never know, because we've been asking for the details of this contract for a number of years. Of course it's up to the government to decide if they felt that the contract was not going in the right direction to terminate if it meant in the long run having to pay more. But we've just got their word for it, because when we asked for the details of why the contract was being terminated, we were told it had gone to arbitration, and therefore all the details were confidential, and we therefore were not allowed to know what the original benchmarks were. They kept saying to us, minister after minister, head of border agency after head of border agency, that the benchmarks had not been fulfilled and the government was the innocent party.
The really frustrating thing, isn't it, is that the original contract was set up in a way and unmonitored in a way that allowed this to go off beam. And that's, it's not the first time that's happened, isn't it? It just calls into question our ability, not so much the decision of the coalition government, which I accept is one thing you want to look into, the actual cancellation, but actually the setting up of the contractual arrangements in the first place.
I agree with you. I don't think it's just about what this government has done, because I don't expect ministers to be experts in computer technology. But some of these people would not know a computer mouse if it sat on their head. And we're talking here about billions of possible computer mice. This is very complicated. And what we need to do is to make sure that we get it right for the next time. There seems to be this defensiveness. What was in the original contract? Who signed it? Why did we not have benchmarks? And why do we not have an e-border system? It's still the case that today, 9 million rail passengers and 8.3 million ferry passengers are not covered by advanced passenger information, which means our borders are simply not as secure as they should be. So that's why it's in the public interest that we should have all the documentation. They should not hide behind arbitration. This is about the way in which we procure IT contracts, and we've got to learn the lessons for future procurement.
Well, I wonder if they will. You're saying we hope we get it right next time. We hope we get it right next time. Will they? Ultimately, this is another side of these privatisations, Martin, isn't it? That the you really don't necessarily know what's in that contract, and that they're often treated as commercially confidential. And when we're seeing this also here in Bristol with some of the activities of the local enterprise partnership with the Bristol Property Board, for example, these things are all going into a secret mode where the public and even councillors are not allowed to know what's happening. For example, we had Gary Hopkins from the Lib Dems on here saying, well, there's all this public money going into the Bristol Arena, but we haven't seen the figures. We can't say as councillors whether this is good value for money for the taxpayer or not.
Well, when I used to work for the council, there was a really big, strong question mark over whether any public money can be committed to anything at all if it's secret. And I would argue that in principle it can't. And that, in fact, many of these contracts might, in fact, be illegal. So, for example, we were talking about asset transfer in the social economy, and there's a real question mark over whether it's legal to transfer public assets to non-public bodies, and that one might be challenged in the courts. And I think that there's a real question mark over whether any public money should be committed to a contract which is which we can't see. And of course, when you're dealing with defence, there's another level of secrecy again. Why don't we get the Chinese to supply our aircraft carriers? They'll put it at a good price, but of course we can't do that, and therefore there's no competition, therefore there's no market, which is why it should all be in the public sector.
Yeah, but you might well say, Ron, you might well find that private contractors will say, well, we can't allow this contract to be, if you want us to bid, we're going to have to keep this contract secret because it's got confidential information about us.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? And it's a particularly sensitive area about national security and, if you like, what might be your frontline equipment in relation to the defence of the realm, etc., etc. There's all manner of things they can hide behind, but Martin's right in relation to the fact that the money they're spending is ours. It's our money that we've earned and paid the taxes for. Yes, we need military procurement, but that military procurement should be open and should be open to scrutiny and checks and balances. And at the minute, from how it's set up, and particularly how this latest issue has cropped up, it seems to me it's becoming even more secretive than it was before.
Okay, on to our next story. And Mayor Ferguson will be attending an amazing event in Amsterdam in mid-September. It's called the Parliament of Mayors. Actually, the particular event is September the 19th. It's in Amsterdam. And it's called If Mayors Ruled the World. Well, I wish a couple of weeks ago when George Ferguson was in here, Lord Ferguson, as we like to call him, I would have loved to have asked him whether he thought it would be a good idea for mayors to rule the world. Although I'm sure you're not quite sure about about what George is going to be doing at this event, Ron. But ultimately, how do you think the mayor is working? It's been going for nearly 2 years now. Do you think it's a successful experiment? No,
no, it's not.
And do you find it? I mean, chatting with the Lib Dems about this a few weeks ago. It seems that there's a little bit of a sort of lowering of morale amongst councillors, feeling, well, actually, we're asking questions, they're not being answered. What are we here for? Would you echo that?
Yes. The ethos that George has put out is that all decisions and the final sign-off is mine. We may have 70 councillors, that all of them could vote together. I hear what you say, but I'm going to ignore you because the Act of Parliament allows me to do so. And he basically said some months ago that, we should all retire to our wards and just not bother with the major decisions. And, in relation to decisions that affect people in this city, this is what we're elected for. And the 70 councillors have got a bigger elected or electorate that voted for them than elected George.
But ultimately, this is the decision of the voters here. Even though it was only a very low turnout, people did vote for a mayor, didn't they?
Well, they did. But unfortunately, I don't think they appreciated fully just how much power was put into the hands of one person and in the hands of an independent, where even if you had a party political mayor, that would have had some immediate checks and balances on what they were trying to do. He is a complete maverick, and he behaves like one. And so, as far as he's concerned, he's reduced the amount of time we can have on questions and scrutiny. He's reduced the ability to ask questions in public. The amount of statements that you can make and the timings that you get is much shorter. And even people in the public gallery are finding it difficult to get answers and questions. And so although he will protest and say that he is open and above board, basically the local ward councillors are, it's like trying to push rocks uphill to get anything done. And it took me 9 months to get him to change his mind in relation to the bedroom tax and no evictions position, which I forced him eventually by using every single, bureaucratic and mechanical process in the council to stop him and to make him change that policy and, more importantly, to record the will of council and 70% of its councillors. He's had to do that, and I had to force him to do it, but it took me 9 months.
Now, I mentioned the arena just now. Some people in the business community are cheering. They're saying, this is wonderful, it's going to be great for Bristol. A lot of other people across the city are saying, well, it's going to cost £90 million. A vast amount of that is actually coming out of our taxpayers' money in the city. Are we going to get value for money? But Gary Hopkins says that they haven't even been allowed to see the figures as to whether this is going to add up or not.
No, I know. That's the point. We don't know. It's a pick and a poke at the minute. And, how much is it going to cost us? And if you put up an arena and the cost of that money against 14,000 people on a waiting list all looking for a home, I know my vote would go for actually building real homes for people in Bristol rather than an arena for pop concerts.
Martin?
Well, I'm not going to dispute that, nor am I going to dispute the fact that I was opposed to having a mayor for the various reasons that Ron's just said. I'm afraid we're stuck with it, though. I can't see how we're going to change it that quickly, and we've got to make some kind of go of this situation with Mayor Ferguson in the driving seat. But I appreciate that what Ron has been doing to try and push him in the right direction in terms of things like the bedroom tax.
What about this whole thing, Ron, about not being able to backtrack? Other cities across the country, they've got mayors, but if they want to have a referendum, they can do. And they can say, well, we've had enough of the mayor, it's not working, we want to go back to the old system.
Well, I was in a local garage today having my car serviced, and I happened to be talking to a barrister from Jersey, and he asked me about the city mayor. And he was appalled that the new Act of Parliament that Bristol got caught up in, and we were the first election for a city mayor after the change of the old legislation, was appalled at the fact that we haven't got that ability to call him to account within a four-year period and to be able to, if you like, replace somebody that we think is doing a bad job.
And will you be signing, because there's a competition on change.org asking for government legislation to allow Bristol to have a referendum. It just seems strange to say, no, you're not allowed to go back, you're only allowed to go in one direction. So are you going to be signing that?
Absolutely.
Martin, what do you think?
Well, I'm trying hard to see how it can work. I mean, if we had what was the situation in other parts of the country before the new legislation? Because we've had mayors before, and referendums to have mayors. What was the arrangement for cancelling it? Who can call the referendum, for example?
Well, it ended up that as I understand it, you had to have a certain number of signatures. There certainly had to be substance in what you were saying. Mm. It was certainly on basis of criticism of expenditure and public money, etc., etc.
So, in other words, you'd have to have a petition with a certain number of signatures.
But you have to have
a referendum.
Okay. Yeah, and I think I may be wrong here, but I think it's Doncaster that's actually reversed its decision. It had a mayor for a while,
that's
decided
right.
It wasn't getting on with it, so they had another referendum, changed their mind.
Exactly.
That's democracy, folks. We haven't got it here in Bristol, I'm afraid, and
no.
I think there's quite a lot of people asking why that is. Not saying that... of course, this sort of thing would also put more pressure on Mayor Ferguson to do what the people want rather than the business community.
You would have hoped so, but it's not.
At the moment, there's no threat to the mayor's position. So, unless there is, it's the next election. How do you think his relations with the business community and the ordinary folk in the city have worked out over the last couple of years, Ron?
What you mean between business, the mayor, and councillors?
Yeah, and also ordinary folk across the city.
Well,
where do his loyalties lie?
Well, my question is, where does George's personal interests and business interests finish, and where does his role as a mayor start? There's certain agencies and groups that he currently sits on and works with, and they're perfectly happy. But there's an awful lot of people that are not happy in relation to some of the indications of what he wants to do for his pet projects. And certainly the residents in my ward, for example, they voted not to have a city mayor, and certainly didn't vote for George, as did all the wards in Bristol East. None of them voted for George at all. And so he tends to pander to the issues and interests of people north of the river.
Martin, I mentioned this September the 19th conference in Amsterdam, if mayors ruled the world. Actually, this organisation, if they did, is that not a good thing?
No. Well, the only good thing, as I said, is that they'd all be in one place and we could obviously pick out the ones that we didn't think were doing a good job.
Okay. Also, this conference, Martin, is about a new form of world, it's what it says on their website, a new form of world government based on mayors.
Yeah, well, it's the whole idea that...
It's completely unofficial.
The concept of decentralisation, and that if you get decentralisation, everything is going to be close to the people, is largely delusionary. In actual fact, well-organised, centralised states are often more... There's more loyalty, for example, in Britain to national than to local government. Always has been, going back, two centuries. People regard local government, which they're close to, as fallible, and central government generally has been better managed than local government. That's the perception.
The Local Government Association and its European equivalent, which is the CEMR, don't even recognise this organisation.
No, and I think also if you think back to when Ken Livingstone was the mayor of London, he wasn't the mayor of London in first. He was the leader of the council, and he was actually answerable to the Labour group.
Correct.
And he never was in favour of having an elected mayor in London. He only stood against the Labour Party and then came back into the Labour Party because that was the obstacle course that had been created. But I believe that Ken Livingstone's position is still that there shouldn't be elected mayors, that we should have the tried and trusted cabinet government system that we've had in this country for a long time, and that within that some person can have a great deal of authority, but they are accountable and answerable to their own party if nothing else.
That's what I was saying earlier, that if you had a party mayor rather than an independent, there is that first natural check and balance in relation to the fact that he's had to rely, or she, in relation to being elected.
Well, St Louis, Missouri has got Ferguson. Bristol's got places like Hartcliffe and St Paul's, and let's hope it doesn't happen here. It's been pretty shocking. And before we discuss the appalling policing and the civil unrest over in the United States with Roland Martin, let's have a listen to one particular person who was a victim of all that, out peacefully protesting. She's Holocaust survivor Hedy Epstein. And what she told reporters was that she believes that Americans are living like under the Nazis.
Our prison system has had some pressure.
And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy.
Sorry about that. Wrong report there. But maybe you two can just discuss what you've seen about what's been going on in the United States, because it looks like some very, very heavy-handed policing has backfired spectacularly, Ron.
Well, looking at the news coverage of it, it's horrendous. I mean, can you imagine Queen Square full of tanks, tear gas, machine guns and everything else? I mean, complete overreaction in relation to an issue where, sadly, a young black youth died and was shot. And I just think it's... you know, God help us if we ever get to that state here.
The interesting thing, of course, is that, but policing, it's interesting, isn't it, that we've been talking over the last 6-8 months on here, including with Superintendent Ian Wiley from the Superintendents Association and Kevin Phillips from the Police Federation about the idea of bringing US police chiefs over to take over our police forces, Martin.
Well, yes, it's, I mean, these things fester for years, and then an event like this suddenly brings the whole thing to people's consciousness. But you've got to remember that I think something like 11,000 people are killed every year with firearms in the US, 3,000 of them by the police. And if we're going to have a more Americanized society, as many people on the right wing of the Conservative Party want, that's their open aspiration, then they've got to get ready for the gun battles that go with being part of the US society. And we're a much smaller country than the US. Those gun battles will be happening in your neighbourhood, unlike in the US where they happen on the other side of town.
Well, let's listen to Holocaust survivor Hedy Epstein, who lives in Ferguson over in St. Louis, Missouri.
We linked arms, the nine of us, and the police and the security people, you know, broke the links and put handcuffs on us, and we were taken to the paddy wagon. Our police are a peace force, not a military force. I mean, they've been given military equipment that's been used in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. Police should not have military equipment, and especially when they don't even know how to use it. And it's like, you know, little boys playing with toys. I was Jewish. And I knew during the Nazi regime that, you know, somebody could just come and do whatever they wanted to me. And that is how African Americans have been living here, not just since 9 days ago, but, you know, for more than a century.
That's Hedy Epstein, who's 90 years old, Ron. It's pretty shocking for her to be accusing the US police of behaving like the Nazis, but her argument there is pretty simple, is they can do what they want to us.
Yes, I know, and I'm thinking about it and while she was speaking. The other layer of militarisation of policing in America, of course, is the National Guard, which we haven't got at the minute. And I just think, you know, for people like that lady there, it must be extremely sad and probably brings back very painful memories of her things that she had to suffer. But I just cannot understand what's going on out there. It just seems to be escalating. And I think Martin's right in relation to the fact we've got to also remember where this is happening, and indeed the repression of the Native Americans in relation to their civil rights, etc., and the whole history of civil rights in America. And I think it's just under the surface, and something like this is a trigger. And it reminds me, the nearest I can remember in my lifetime is Margaret Thatcher and the miners' strike, and the way in which she tried to militarise the police then in relation to what they did in relation to peaceful protest on the basis of mine closures.
Martin, a lot of talk here of race wars in the United States, but it certainly looks to me as if this is actually much more to do with poverty, general impossibility of getting jobs over there, people being evicted because of the economic situation. Ultimately, we in Britain are behind the US. We've actually got not quite as many unemployed generally here. But what are your thoughts about this whole business of surely most of the Western world, including other parts of Europe, because of the whole situation with debt, we've got almost inevitably there's going to be civil unrest based on this lack of jobs, lack of food, and lack of opportunities for the poor. It's like once upon a time there was this idea that there was a certain level under which, a poverty line under which, the government would not allow you to fall, would make sure that you've got benefits in order to feed yourself, stay in your home, this kind of thing, and that is slowly being dismantled over here. And so in a way, what's happened in Ferguson, the way we're heading now, is almost inevitable to finally arrive on our doorsteps here.
Well, that's right. And also, of course, when you've got long-term permanent structural unemployment of military-age young people, you're basically begging for trouble, whether it's in the US or Britain or anywhere else. We've got 1 million people under the age of 25 unemployed in this country, which means there must be 500,000 lads of military age who have no employment at the moment. It's surprising that the place hasn't been torn apart already, actually. It's because people in Britain do put up and shut up. But, of course, what all it takes is a trigger, as we saw a few years ago in this country. The shooting by the police of a young fellow set off a rioting which killed five people.
OK, from a macroeconomic point of view, if you were sitting in the Chancellor George Osborne's shoes in his desk up at the Treasury, what would you be banging your fist on the table about? What would you be making, decisions would you be making to turn this around, to make sure that actually there are enough jobs for everybody? When we're told the Bristol Arena is going to provide jobs, well, it's going to certainly provide a few jobs temporarily. It's certainly not going to make much of an inroad into the massive national debt that we seem to be spending more and more of our time paying taxes just to pay these debts off, which are getting bigger all the time.
The decision not to have full employment is a political decision. It was taken in the late 1970s, first by Labour governments and then by Conservative governments, because if you were going to keep a full employment policy, you either have to tolerate inflation, which erodes the wealth of the wealth-owning classes, or you've got to tax those wealth-owning classes to close the deficit. If you're not prepared to do that, you then are basically making a political decision to have unemployment rather than inflation or tax rises. Now, that's a political decision. So when people are left, we're talking about 1 million young people under the age of 25 in this country without work, older people like myself struggling, when you make that decision, that's a political decision. Now, it may be that the modern capitalist economy can't provide the old-fashioned wage-earner jobs, family-keeping jobs. Don't forget, in the 1950s, full employment was defined as a chap working enough to keep his family and two kids and so on. We may have to, I think we will eventually have to go towards a citizen's income setup, where everybody basically gets a basic income as a citizen's right. I know you might.
But we're a million miles away from that, Martin. We were just discussing last week a Joseph Rowntree Trust survey, I think it was, that was saying that even if both parents are working, there's still not enough money coming in for childcare, for example.
Well, that's why we'd have to.
On average, anyway,
we need to move towards a socialist society with a residual market economy. I know that sounds utopian as we're speaking, but don't forget the capitalist economy itself is actually a utopian experiment which is about to go horribly wrong. And once people have realised that business as usual is over, then we can start talking about the kind of society we really want, which will be a probably about 60-70% public sector with a residual private sector about 30%.
Ron, what are your thoughts about it? I mean, it's a giant great tanker, the economy. It seems to be heading now over the Niagara Falls. How do we turn it round?
Well, I think the nearest thing I can look at is America after the two world wars, where the government took a decision to invest in public works to keep people in employment and to build things that we actually really needed. And I keep coming back to housing again in Bristol. You know, I would like to see, and we know from national figures, that there's a need to build 250,000 homes a year, new ones, just to stand still.
Okay, but where is the money going to come from, Ron? It doesn't seem to be any coming along on the horizon.
Well, if you structure the investment in social housing in a way in which people get a return from it, which is what I've suggested to the Labour group in Bristol, from pension funds and other people that have got money to invest, if you invest in the people and the homes that they sit in, you create work and you keep the local economy buoyant.
Okay, we're going to move on now to quite a shocking cover on the Daily Mail saw on Wednesday this week. The headline is, "Do you want us to let you die? Nurses are visiting the elderly at home to see whether they would agree to a do not resuscitate order. They're asking patients they have never met sensitive medical questions, including what should happen if their health suddenly fails. A do not resuscitate DNR order instructs the doctors not to try to restart a heart that stopped beating, for example. The questionnaire is a part of an NHS England scheme to improve care of the elderly, keep them out of hospital. It's not clear why do not resuscitate is on the forms. Medical experts fear vulnerable patients will feel pressured into giving their consent simply to avoid causing trouble. Peter Carter of the Royal College of Nursing said, I've never heard of anything like it. These questions are usually only asked when the nurse has developed a good and meaningful relationship with the patient. Only then will the nurse begin broaching these difficult subjects. It's truly extraordinary within a few minutes of meeting someone to ask them where they want to die and to sign a form. Nurses shouldn't be put in that position. Ron, you first on this one. I mean, we've had this thing called the Liverpool Care Pathway as well that the Daily Mail's exposed, doing some actually quite amazing work in getting that out into the public domain, where people were actually being deprived of liquids and things on wards. It does seem, as we move towards a more commercialised health service, that elderly patients who are ill are being seen as a burden, and that there is actually increasing pressure for them to be persuaded to... in a way, it's just a kind of voluntary euthanasia.
Well, it seems to me to be the first step towards possibly taking people of my age at 71 and saying, you're too old for us to bother to spend any more money on you because we got to concentrate on the younger ones. The NHS was set up, as you know, free at the point of delivery and available on demand for everybody, regardless of age. That, I think, is totally unfair pressure for all the reasons the paper, and I'm not a great supporter of the Mail, but on this one I think they got it right. And indeed, in relation to the vulnerability of patients that maybe are under medication or not feeling well or whatever, to be put into that situation, I think is horrendous. And the other thing I'd say in relation to that is I know that there is a great pressure and need for organ replacement, but to be able to pressurise people again, will you give up X, Y and Z to sign this? I think that's something that people should be left to decide on their own without being pressured by the state or the state's health service.
Martin, what do you think about this? Do you want us to let you die forms being taken around to patients?
Well, I mean, the danger is that it is being used as a cost-cutting measure, and that's completely unacceptable. Human life is not to be treated in that way. But on the other hand, I do have sympathy with those who would like some regularisation of this whole process of whether people should be allowed to decide to die and all the rest of it.
But I mean, how you do that, surely, I mean, it's much, much more sensitive to do it with the family rather than to come around with a clipboard and say, please sign
that's
here.
That's obviously an unacceptable way to proceed. without any doubt.
What are your thoughts about the sorts of changes that are happening in healthcare in Britain and how they're related to privatisation?
Well, let's just put it this way. In the United States of America, they don't ask you, would you like us to let you die? They simply let you die if you haven't got health insurance, and millions of people haven't.
So
and they die in the streets, quite literally.
And what's the difference between that and what we set up in the NHS here in the 1940s?
In principle, everybody is treated in Britain. And, of course, that makes sense. So say you've got some foreigners coming here, maybe with Ebola. Of course you treat them. Otherwise, they're wandering around the streets. And the British healthcare system is not only the best in the world in terms of outcomes, it's also the cheapest. Finance systems that are based on individual insurance are inevitably much more expensive. So the US spends a far higher proportion of its GNP on healthcare than we do. And millions of people, quite literally, nobody even asks them the question, shall we let you die? They do just let you die. And that's what happens if you're poor. Many people in Ferguson will die in their own homes without medical attention, I'm quite sure.
Also, one of the things we're going to be looking at in future weeks is statins. There was a story just earlier this month, again in the Mail, the British Medical Journal stands by claims on side effects of statins. And there's a lot of pressure from the pharmaceutical industry to make sure that these kinds of drugs, long-term drugs, are prescribed. Actual financial penalties if they don't prescribe them. All of a sudden it seems that the doctor's actual own judgment is meaning less and less, which is a real pity, you know, because that's what they're there for. Okay, final story this week. Double Gloucester is to disappear from the UK as cows die out. The traditional Double Gloucester cheese is set to disappear from Britain's shores after experts warn the breed of cow which produces it is dying out. This is in the Daily Express earlier on this week. Traditional slice of the now endangered Double Gloucester cheese. They even got a picture of it there. Farmers claim there's now fewer than 450 Gloucester cattle left in the country due to TB regulations and lack of breeder interest. If the breed should become extinct, it would spell a definitive end to single Gloucester cheese and the real Double Gloucester, which is only made from pedigree cows. Ron, what do you make of this?
Well, that's a bit sad, because I always enjoy a good ploughman's lunch, and I also enjoy cheese. And so if we're going to lose Double Gloucester, I think that's sad. Obviously, the cattle rare breeds people are probably working like mad to try and help and not to let this happen. But if we lose both the cows and the cheese, that would be a disaster to me, I think.
Martin, back in the 1970s, there was lots of enthusiasm to increase the numbers of the Gloucester breed of cattle. However, all of those farmers are now in their 80s. There are less efforts. Back in 1972, the breed was in danger of dying out, with only 60 bovines actually left in Britain. But a small group of dedicated farmers worked furiously to increase herds to almost 1,000 by the 1990s. Now, the Gloucester breed, which has a white belly, a white tail, and a stripe down its spine, is in danger once again, with only 450 registered cattle still alive. Anyway, thanks very much to Ron Stone. We'll be talking Libya, we hope, if the phones are working, after the news.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, in the last few minutes, Malky Mackay has broken his silence over allegations he was involved with racist, sexist and homophobic text messages while Cardiff manager. The GFA is investigating him along with former colleague Ian Moody. Mackay has admitted sending messages that were disrespectful of other cultures, but he says there weren't many of them.
I sent 3. Looking at them, they are completely unacceptable, inappropriate, and for that, and any offence I've caused, I sincerely apologise.
The Foreign Secretary says there won't be any alliance with the President of Syria to try to defeat Islamic State fighters in the region. It comes as nearly 70 people have died in a mass shooting at a mosque in eastern Iraq. The BBC's been accused of a cover-up over its role in the police raid on Sir Cliff Richard's home. South Yorkshire Police Chief David Crompton says he's complained to Director General Lord Hall after the corporation's journalists appeared on the scene before his officers. MP Keith Faz